Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast. I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of MD Magazine, and I'll be your host for this special edition of Doc Talk. Normally, our show features a one-on-one conversation between MD Mag and a clinical expert. Each episode is typically 10 to 20 minutes and focuses on one topic of healthcare at a time. But this week's episode is going to be a bit different. About a month ago, I was asked to moderate a panel discussion on mental health stigma with a team of public healthcare policy and advocacy experts. The panel was part of the second annual Advancing Mental Health Policy Better Together Forum from Otsuka America Pharmaceutical, hosted in Washington, D.C. Today's episode is actually the live recorded audio of that 45-minute discussion, featuring the excellent insights of our panel, Tammy Boyd, Chief Policy Officer of Black Women's Health Imperative, John Snook, Executive Director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, and Jeff Valliere, Director of Communications at Faster Cures. We hope you enjoy the talk.
All right, everyone can hear me? Great, excellent. Good morning, and thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having us here today. Thank you for being here with us. My name is Kevin Kunzman. I'm the Managing Editor of MD Magazine. Just wanted to get into a quick introduction before we went down the line. Since 1999, annual suicide rates have increased by more than 25% in the U.S. This data comes from a 2018 CDC study, which also showed that all but one state in our country has seen an increase of at least 6% in annual suicides, including our nation's capital. This same study also showed that 54% of suicide decedents were never diagnosed nor treated for a mental health illness. Most suicide patients die untreated, undiagnosed. Stigma in mental health is not exhausted from decades of proposed resolution and rhetoric, nor does it benefit from being a recent discovery. It is more recognized and more burdensome by the day. And really, when we talk about mental stigma, we're not limited to depression or suicidality. Conditions such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder carry more perverse, extreme interpretations by public and media that are quick to associate psychiatric disease with violence, instability, and fear. This morning, our panel of experts who range in their backgrounds in mental health policy, advocacy, and care will be discussing the stigmas and social barriers surrounding mental health. We'll also establish methods to improve understanding, education, collaboration, and feasible action towards reducing the effects of stigma. And the best way to do that may be in just defining the issue itself. So let's go down the row right now. If you can take a minute to introduce yourself and tell us, how would you define stigma and its impact on mental health?
Yeah. Thank you. My name is Tammy Boyd. I'm with the Black Women's Health Imperative, Chief Policy Officer and Counsel. My background is worked on Capitol Hill, and then also now working for a nonprofit. Specifically, how I would define stigma is there's a shame and an embarrassment associated with stigma, and particularly in the Black community. That stigma is also a barrier to care. So generally speaking, we define stigma as much of what we've already heard.
And I'm John Snook. I run the Treatment Advocacy Center, which you heard about a few moments ago. I think for us, it's important to understand just how pervasive stigma is, especially around serious mental illness. I think as we arrive at this event, we see how pervasive stigma is. If any of you walked here from the metro, you saw many people with untreated serious mental illness on the streets of DC. We heard earlier from Kabir that most people with serious mental illness aren't dangerous. But unfortunately, DC, like lots of places, says we aren't going to provide care for people with serious mental illness unless you pose a danger. And what that means is most people, especially if you have serious mental illness, just simply don't get care. Or you get care through the systems that can't say no to you, law enforcement. And that's why we have such stigma, because if you're a person on the street and you're told the way you get care for an illness is that you're dangerous, why wouldn't you think people with mental illness are dangerous? That's the standard for care. It must be part of the illness. And that's what we're fighting back against. People are finally taking serious mental illness seriously, and it's an opportunity for us all to say, we need to just completely redo the entire system.
Great. Jeff Valliere, I'm the Director of Communications for Faster Cures. We're a center of the Milken Institute based here in Washington, D.C. And to really boil down what we do is we put patients in the center of the healthcare system, both patients themselves for biomedical innovation, but also patient experiences, and allowing those patient experiences to influence policy decisions, to influence the development of new treatments and therapies, and ultimately accelerating cures. And so when we talk about stigma in mental health, what we're talking about is really two things. The first is the structural stigma that exists around public policies, frankly, that haven't kept pace with the need, and the study that John and his organization did about the role of law enforcement, I think is very, very prescient for this conversation and also for the larger conversation that's happening out in the world today, especially when there are incidents of violence, for example, shootings. What's the first thing that the media goes to? Well, what was the problem, quote unquote, with this person? What was their illness? The second, and they blame mental health, and then they move on. The second is more environmental stigma. And I think when we have people with great bravery, like Deborah, who will get up and tell her story, like Kabir, who got up and told his story, when we have members of Congress who are willing to tell their stories, when we have people in our communities who are willing to tell their stories, that environmental stigma, the stigma that surrounds all of us, begins to lower. It begins to become more acceptable. And, talking about mental illness becomes more acceptable, not the stigma, obviously. And there's a responsibility imperative in that. And that is a responsibility from the media. It's a responsibility from popular culture. It's a responsibility for journalists to learn how to talk about mental illness and to, as Deborah said earlier, change the narrative. How do we talk about mental health and addiction, let's not forget about addiction in all of this, in the right way to lower that stigma? So when we think about it, and I think about it from the perspective of Faster Cures and the Milken Institute, I think about it as how can we accelerate the next generation of treatments so that people feel comfortable and they have access and they can actually get well, because people do get well.
Those are excellent answers, and you sort of segued a little bit into our next portion, which is understanding the categories of, you know, expert-led definition of stigma, broken up into three subsets, being self, social, and structural stigma. Exactly what is the interrelation of all of these together from your own expertise, and do we see instances of when we're working to combat destigmatization that there's some overlap in how we're addressing these, either one at a time, two at a time, or even all three at once? John, do you want to start off with any examples?
Sure. I think one of the most obvious, and it's so ridiculous that it's actually hard to message. We brought a communications firm in to help us with some of the messaging around it, and they said, the first thing you gotta do is convince people that this issue is real, because people don't believe it. And that's the IMD exclusion. That there is a provision in Medicaid that says, we will pay for care for any other sort of inpatient care besides two, substance abuse and serious mental illness. And if you told somebody on the street that the federal government decided we're just not going to pay for inpatient care for serious mental illness, when the crisis is so pervasive and on people's doorsteps, they just simply don't believe it. And that moment, that reality, is so stigmatizing. Because one, the fact that that is allowed to happen just shows the stigma that mental illness has had, that we just simply haven't paid attention to fix that, that it's just sitting there. But it also builds that structural stigma, because what that means is there aren't enough treatment beds for people when they get seriously ill. That when the choice is jail, homelessness, or treatment, too often, treatment just isn't there. And so the stigma builds up. And I think the conversations around violence make this more difficult, because the reality is that there is a significant percentage of people with serious mental illness for whom violence is a concern. But the reason is not because serious mental illness is bad or these people are bad or anything like that. It's that we do the worst job of caring for people when they're at their sickest. And that's, again, that stigma, that people on the street think of serious mental illness as that dangerous person, not that person that's in care. And that's what we need to change.
I think it's fairly interesting to point out that social and structural stigma certainly drive the self-stigma that we see in patients. Before they even have a chance to perceive their diagnosis, they're exposed to their own thoughts and perception as to how they're going to be treated in public, seeking care, overall interacting with people in a capacity where suddenly they have maybe a secret or maybe something to bear that is unfair to someone else that may just have a general illness. It is an illness, and
exactly.
It gets put into a different category.
And I can, piggyback off of that. I mean, one of the things that we looked at, we did a study, we surveyed a large group of Black women, but one of the things is that, in terms of their perceptions, and one of the perceptions was that they had to be perfect, or, you have to be able to take care of your family, but then also balance, your kids, and so if you didn't do that, you were perceived as a failure, or then you'd be depressed. But then, again, one of the barriers of that is not going and seeking and getting the right medication. Mm-hmm. And then also, to sort of piggyback off what you said, even another layer would be even the way the healthcare system treats, health conditions. It's different. There's not parity with mental health in regular in other health areas. So.
For sure.
I would add to that we have an unequal system of care. We treat the brain as if it's not part of the body. That in and of itself is stigmatizing. So if somebody is lucky enough, first of all, I think access is a huge issue mm-hmm. in terms of what we're talking about here. Access, we could do a whole panel on just access challenges that exist with the physician shortage, with reimbursement issues that are prevalent in the environment right now, especially as we think about what the future of, is it going to be Medicare for all, which is a big subject of last, they talked about it for half an hour, 45 minutes last night, and mental health and addiction really didn't make it into the discussion. So that separate and unequal system of care, when we think about what that actually says to somebody who is seeking help for a mental health condition or an addiction, it basically says, we don't have space for you, we don't want to talk to you, we don't think you can actually pay for this. And one of the things that we have to really think about as we talk about these access issues and about stigma is how do we ensure that the system of care that we have today keeps up with the needs of the future as people become more literate around issues of mental health and addiction, right? As schools begin to teach mindfulness, as they begin to teach about stress reduction and stress management practices, how do we create the system of the future, bring the brain back into the body so that it is treated equally? And these are serious challenges. These are challenges that we have to tackle, not just as professionals in the field, but we have to tackle these issues as voters, as citizens, as engaged people in the world who have family members or even themselves who are being denied access because of a failed or broken system.
Excellent. Great. And I know we're pitching this as sort of a dire situation right now, but speaking a little optimistically, in recent decades, we've obviously evolved our understanding. Obviously, this session today is a reflection of that, but it would be interesting, I think, to see exactly what people think of mental health stigma in 2019. So my next question to you guys would be, how would you imagine exactly if we go out and just broad canvas survey everyone and ask them, what does mental illness mean to you? How do modern influences affect their perception of it compared to what we were dealing with previously? You want to go, Jeff?
Sure. I think it comes back to a few things. It's a great question because, when we do surveys and polls and ask people, there's not one typical answer like there is for a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. People come at this with their own filters, and their filters could be developed and determined by the messages they receive in the media. It could be developed and pushed by some of the messages that they get from the healthcare system. It could also be developed and determined by their own personal or family experiences. And when we look at the state of mental health and addiction in 2019, And if we want to tell a good news story, I'll go back to what I said before, that there's more general awareness out there in the world about mental health. I mean, there are no shortage of apps. If you go on the app store right now and you want to do mindfulness, I bet you'll find 100 different apps. And that's not the be-all, end-all, but it's definitely something that I think has changed the dynamics of the conversation. I think if you were to look at the way Hollywood and popular culture has dealt with it, they're lagging somewhat, but there are glimmers of hope, and I think that there's a concerted and very well-organized constituency. A lot of those folks are in this room today, and I would say this room is part of that constituency, that are willing to push back on false portrayals, willing to push back through social media, through their own channels, through their own engagement, on things that are stigmatizing and don't work. So the state, if we were to give it a grade, so to speak, I think we're still a C student on all of this, right? But it is getting better. There's definitely cause for hope in certain areas. I just saw a story in Stat maybe 3 days ago that the pipeline for pharmaceutical interventions is very robust right now. There are lots of new treatments that are coming down the pike. Could there be more? Yes, absolutely. Do we need to think about that holistically? Absolutely. But that is a good news story. And there are things that we need to do as a community to make sure that those moments of progress continue and that we're not stuck in a rut, which is where I think we've been for a very long time, where we take maybe, you know, two steps forward and then one step back.
That's a great point. And I would add to that, too. If we're talking about, you know, being a different kind of C student, I think a new issue that sort of presented itself in 2019 is Dr. Google. Mm-hmm. We talk about it a lot. Of course, you know, someone has a cold and suddenly they have cancer 5 minutes later because they, you know, searched it. But I think we see that a lot, too. And certainly my generation, I hear it all the time. Someone's been sad for a couple of days. They're definitely depressed. They didn't go see a doctor. They didn't talk to anyone about it. They're not receiving medication. There's no formality to it, but they're depressed. They're a depressed person. They're down. Or flippant jokes of, I definitely have bipolar. I definitely have this. Very quick to assess themselves as having an issue because they have these resources at hand, and there's still that broken barrier, I think, to, you know, direct physicians that will tell them exactly what's going on and lead them to the proper magnitude of care.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, one piece that I see, I think we are at a moment of time, we're really at the precipice of what I think is going to be, I think we're going to look back in 5 years and say, this was a really interesting moment in time. I look especially, I was just out in the West Coast, and in Los Angeles, the city was planning to build a $6 billion mental health jail because the Twin Towers, the jail there, was so damaging, was just simply not built for the level of people with serious mental illness that they were dealing with. And the underserved community, especially in Los Angeles, really stepped up. Patrice Cullors, who some of you may have heard of, who helped found Black Lives Matter, largely because of the experiences of her brother, Monty, who has been criminalized because of his schizophrenia, really led a campaign that galvanized the entire city to say, we should not spend $6 billion on a mental health jail. We should spend that money on treatment beds, on getting people care. And I think it's a really interesting moment in time because the sheriffs around the country have been saying the same thing. And so you have this moment where underserved communities, law enforcement, just people on the street are saying, oh my gosh, you guys are finally paying attention? Yes, this is terrible. Get in the game. And so when you have a presidential debate that doesn't even mention it, I think that's a real miss. And I think they're going to look back and recognize they did not take advantage of that opportunity when they should have.
I think that's also important. I mean, we are in a time where you are also seeing the medical community and other key stakeholders come to the table to talk about how can we, you know, get a little deeper than, you know, there's stigma, but how do we actually address, for example, you know, mistrust in the system? How do we also include culturally competent care in the medical school curriculums? So I think we are at a key time where all the key stakeholders are coming to the table.
Excellent. And as we said before, obviously, stigma generally manifests in mental health in extreme perceptions, and one of the biggest drivers of that is fear, of course, and it often plays a bigger role in the public's misunderstanding of exactly the role of stigma in mental health. How can we begin to correct the culture of fear? Would you want to start that, Tammy?
One way would be including in the schools, also beginning to have these conversations, also beginning to look at the different layers of the stigma and how to address those issues. So, you know, sort of similar to what I said, but really getting deeper and having those conversations.
Sure. And I really see it as both a top-down and bottom-up opportunity. That's right. I think the focus on parity, the focus on recognizing mental illness is like an illness like any other, really is vital. That messaging needs to come from the top down. But at the same time, we have to prioritize care because people build stigma from what they see. And if they think that mental illness is untreatable, they're simply not going to take it seriously. And we need to make sure people understand that you can get care, that care works, and the opportunities are there.
I'll echo that sentiment. I think that's incredibly important, that top-down and bottom-up approach. And I think early intervention is critical. And I think that it can't just be a one-size-fits-all solution for early intervention. We have to engage the schools. We have to engage communities. We have to engage the broader healthcare system. We have to engage nonprofits. We have to engage community groups. We have to look at it from a person-to-person, community-to-community, county-by-county, state-by-state, rubric. We have to look at it that way, because the way that we're going to lower stigma, the way that we're going to sort of change the portrayals and perceptions of mental health and addiction is by taking that sort of approach, that we need better public policies up here, absolutely, but we need communities to be engaged, and not engaged during Mental Health Week, not being engaged one day a year, but being engaged on this as a community. Because when you look at what communities can do when they come together, you can look at different sectors, you can look at different, when there's a flood, when there's a fire, communities do come together. And frankly, the house is burning right now on some of these things, and we need to come together as a community and start fixing some of these. But we also need models. We need things that can help that early intervention and prevention, frankly, rubric to actually take hold. And that, I think, over time will lower that perception of mental health conditions and substance use disorders as scary, as different. It happens to those people over there. It doesn't happen in my family. It certainly isn't me. So it's those structural things that need to change, frankly.
And to sort of rally off your point, Tammy, I'd certainly see it as a 1A, 1B situation. We're at the foundation of it, education. And I would also add to that media, of course. Mm-hmm. We were just talking earlier. I've seen such a huge embrace into new scientific evidence guidelines, trying to direct journalists and the media into their depiction and coverage overall of these tragedies. It's such a quick gimmick to point to the mental standing of a person who has perpetrated a violent act, as opposed to focus on, you know, the tragedy itself and what needs to be done now and the basic facts of it. It almost becomes something of a witch hunt for psychiatric illness at that point. So those are going to be certainly critical if we want people to feel less afraid and more willing to help and combat the issue directly.
You actually said something, Kevin, earlier today when we were talking that I want to let everybody think about here, which is you're a journalist, Deborah's a journalist. We have other people here who work in communications, I'm sure, or who themselves have been journalists. First 100 words of a story makes all the difference.
Yes.
So how do we get the right, you know, the right language? How do we get the right framing? How do we make sure that we're not stigmatizing in word 3, 4, and 5 by using the wrong kind of language, using stigmatizing language, using just flat out inaccurate language? So, I mean, maybe as we move through the day here and we talk about more of these issues, coming back to some of those really fundamental issues that need to change. And as a journalist, I think you are aware, Deborah, obviously you're aware because of your story and the way that you've approached this issue. But the media, as you said, has an incredibly powerful role here to change the narrative, to change the dynamics and cover things the right way.
Yeah, we have the attention for only a few seconds, but we have the attention. And mm-hmm. It's critical that, you know, the introduction to what they're about to learn over the following days, weeks, months, years, dependent on the severity of a tragedy or anything related to it, it needs to be focused on the tragedy itself. It cannot be emphasizing perceptions or ideas of what motivated this person, what's wrong with them, before you actually get into the true tragedy. So mental illness, it currently reaches, as we said, 1 in 5 U.S. adults. It theoretically touches the entire population, I would say. We're all influenced and affected in one way or another. This, knowing someone with mental illness, does that matter in helping to break stigma? And if so, do patients now hold a responsibility to come forward and be open and honest about it?
Who would want to start? Well, I can take. I think, you know, it's similar to if someone has cancer or diabetes, or I think it's, you know, up to each individual if they want to share their story. But I do think when folks come forward and share their story, that it provides this, it normalizes it in a sense, mm-hmm. Where others are, they also feel free to share their stories. It's more of like a safe space. So it's not necessarily a responsibility. I think it's their individual choice whether they want to do it. But sharing their story definitely, I think, helps move the conversation forward.
Sure. And I think the reality of the conversation, it's almost, a responsibility is too far, but I think there's an opportunity. I think the conversations are changing. I know I've been going up on the Hill talking about these issues for years, and you would never have a member of Congress flag their own experience. And the conversations have changed. You know, someone during a meeting or immediately after will say, you know, I have a loved one who's been struggling with care. I've been reached out to by a number of my constituents who are really struggling. How do we fix this? And I think that's the opportunity, is bringing forth those conversations to say, the system is largely broken, and you as policymakers need to step up. And so I think conversations like this are really helpful because we're at that moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just build on that by saying, you know, as a communications professional, as somebody who spent the last 22 years working on these issues from a communication standpoint, from messaging, from trying to influence the way coverage is happening, branding, et cetera, stories have power. We know that. Stories have power. People will identify their own experience or the experience of their family if they see someone being brave and telling their story to a group of people. But we can't force them to do that, right? People will do this in their own way, in their own time. I think there have been some, in the last 10 years, 15 years, there have been some real game changers. There's been the rise of social media, which, for better or for worse, has given people a platform if they choose to share. I mean, you know, there's a lot of garbage out there, but there's some moments of hope. People who are able to, and organizations who are able to harness that for good, are actually making a dent in the way people experience these issues and the way that they can tell their story. We have opportunities like the one we're sitting in today to tell stories and to bring personal experiences into the mix. And we have, I think, to John's point, we have people in positions of power on the national level and on the state level who are willing to leverage that storytelling into better public policies, into influencing the way we talk about these issues. And that cannot be discounted. And so when I think about how the media, for example, operates on this level, stories is pretty much all they have. So let's get the right stories out there. Let's make sure that people who are willing to tell their stories have the tools to tell their stories effectively. And let's turn people, this is not a bold idea, but let's turn people who are interested in these issues, who have a personal connection to them on any level, let's also turn them into advocates. Because as you know, John, Tammy will tell you, working on the Hill or trying to influence the way public policy is made on the Hill, you have to come prepared with tangible, real-life stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's our opportunity.
Absolutely. It's almost as if we might be getting a step ahead of ourselves, and we need to consider the fact of whether we're giving patients a proper platform to navigate mm-hmm. that discussion before we ask them to do that. But it is good to know that we do have communities that are set and more available in the modern age that allow for that conversation. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, otherwise, do you think that's something that in all the improvements that we've made, like going back to you said, going from one C grade to a different kind of C grade. Is that one of the improvements that we've been able to make, is that we're giving them a proper platform to feel comfortable to come out about that and have backing once that's out?
I think that's the necessary ingredients to really catalyze change at the end of the day. I think these issues are all obviously always going to lag from a policy perspective. It's going to take a while for decision makers to understand. But if you're on the ground, you know how pertinent these issues are to the community. I look at Iowa. Iowa is obviously on the radar for a lot of politicians right now. In the gubernatorial race that they just had last year, the polling showed that mental health crises were the number one issue that voters were voting on. That's an opportunity. Iowa also happens to be 50th in treatment beds, if you happen to be paying attention. And we released a study a few months ago that showed that law enforcement spends about 20% of their time responding to or transporting people with serious mental illness, that they spend $1 billion a year on these issues. And so if you're on the ground in a county level, if you're a family member trying to make the case to a policymaker, that's an opportunity. If communities are rising up, we have the chance to really make sure policymakers are paying attention. And if they're not, we have the opportunity to punish them for that.
Okay. Mental health, it generally presents very differently across our very diverse population, and it calls for a need for culturally competent destigmatization efforts. How exactly does that manifest now, and what more do we need to do to get to that space?
Well, so one of the most obvious problems is that there are far too many people who look like me and older who are psychiatrists, that it is a profession that is largely old white guys. I sat on the Virginia Tech panel following the tragedy now almost 20 years ago, and cultural competency was one of the linchpins in that conversation, was that he was Korean American and that the Korean church had just not been engaged whatsoever to talk about these issues. And I think that's hugely problematic still to this day. We have huge numbers of community opportunities like that, churches that just simply have no mental health engagement from the industry. And I think that the folks in this room and then who are watching have a responsibility to take advantage of that moment in time that people are paying attention to. But I'll stop talking.
I mean, in addition, again, to training our providers, I think also, listening to, sort of as you mentioned, the actual community, making sure in the messaging as you're crafting, even PSAs or materials for outreach to the community, that the community is also included in that, so that we can know what resonates. For example, for Black women, sort of what resonates. I mean, a lot of the times they go to, instead of seeking mental health providers or medication, they may go to the church. Right. So, being able to, talk to them and create a messaging where, you can also go to your spiritual counselor, but then you can't look away from access to mental health medication or treatment. So I think also including in the right folk, a diverse group at the table.
And just to piggyback off that, that's certainly how we see the issue manifest on my side in terms of covering it in the media, is these groups not understanding the bridge or not being aware or informed or educated on the bridge to direct care. There was a study for cardiovascular-based patients in based in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles. They established a handful of barbershops that were capable of checking blood pressure for patients, and they were able to significantly reduce the rate of heart disease risk over just a span of 1 year. People come in for a haircut and, hey, while you're here, have you gotten your blood pressure checked? No, I haven't in years. Okay, well, here's a chance right now. So kind of bridging that gap between, community access, the church, like you said, maybe the schools, along with actual direct care, it's a really fascinating way to go, but it seems like it could work.
Mm-hmm. What's that bottom-up approach that you talked about, right? It's that community by community, person by person. And I think there's enough creativity out there in the world to think about what are those moments of intervention? Where are those points where you could ask somebody, how are you feeling?
Exactly.
How is your mom doing? How is your dad? How are you doing? And getting away from this notion of one size fits all. It doesn't, especially when we're talking about these issues, and especially when we're dealing with an opioid overdose crisis, where there are communities that are also in crisis. You need to have a community by community approach to these kinds of things.
And it's also something, it's a resolution that helps improve on the physician shortage, like we were talking
about. For sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. And, stigma also plays a role in actual patient care avoidance, obviously. Treatment non-adherence is a major issue in this space. How can we better promote or normalize mental health care for patients who may be reticent to embrace their disease?
I worry a little bit when we put the onus on patients. I think the conversation needs to be flipped. I think the reality that the duration of untreated psychosis is measured in years rather than days or weeks. If we were talking about stroke or other cardiovascular events and we were saying, well, they're non-adherent, and you'd say, well, it took you 3 years to treat them, it would be a much different conversation. I think the reality is we have to make services much more available, and we have to intervene and make that opportunity for intervention far upstream from what we do today, and not say, there's nothing we can do until your loved one's dangerous. And then once they're finally dangerous, we say, well, they seem dangerous, call the cops. That's just a broken system. And that's what we need to fix.
Absolutely. From my perspective, enforce the parity law, make it stronger.
That's a great point. Mm-hmm.
It's not a quick fix, nor is it going to fix everything across the spectrum, but it will put the brain back into the body in terms of how the healthcare system looks at it more generally, how payers look at it, how providers look at it. And that, when we think about what are the tools that we already have in the toolbox? Well, we have this law. It's gone largely unenforced. There was a ruling several months ago that kind of unstuck some of it and moved a little bit of it forward. Some states are working on it, obviously. That's one thing. And I think moving more toward a system where we collaborate around care, where we look at how the body and the brain work together, not just in terms of the biology, but in terms of the system and bringing everything together under one roof. But again, the parity piece of this cannot be overstated. It's an incredibly important tool that we have.
That's a great point.
And I agree. I think that, once you have, even after you have the parity conversation, in terms of reimbursement, then you can also begin to have sort of the social determinants sort of conversation, like what are some of the reasons why patients aren't taking their medications, or what are some of the reasons why they're not making their appointments? So in addition to the parity aspect, which I agree, is also looking at and examining sort of some of the environmental factors and the social determinants as well.
Great point.
And to add on to that, even in instances where patients are adhering to the therapy, we talked to a psychiatrist. My team talked to a psychiatrist in the past week, and they pointed out a pretty novel issue in that people who are adhering to their therapy, if they're being treated for schizophrenia, have a false interpretation of what that means. They believe, I'm good. I've been taking my drugs. They're not worried about whether the dose needs to be upped. If like their actual state is improving in any capacity, they have this perception of it being under control. So as long as they're following this direct order, they're not coming in for checkups and monitoring and gauging the symptoms and understanding exactly what's happening to them. It's, here's my medicine, I take this, I'm good. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to think that we just need to really improve the capabilities of patients to understand what they're going through at any given time from start to finish.
In a certain respect, this, what you just mentioned, and I think it's fascinating, obviously, and it's something that I think we sort of struggle with in general. I think putting patients, like I was mentioning before about our goal at Faster Cures, to put patients in the center of the system and their experiences in the center of the system, mine that information to help the system make better decisions and be a little bit more responsive. But there is a tool that we haven't talked about here today that could be part of this equation, which is telemedicine. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, that is an untapped resource for us. I mean, there's many, many companies that are coming up. There's, you know, the VA is doing a lot in this area. But if we could make it easier through technology for people to share their experience with a professional, to your point about, I take the pill and I'm better, but how are you feeling on this score, on that score? And with a system that has a shortage of providers, why aren't we moving more aggressively in that direction, I think is the question.
John, you were just talking about Iowa's access and issue it being now the top public health concern of the entire state. This is a prime location for exposure to telemedicine opportunities, middle America.
Exactly.
The ratio doctor to patient is absurd. And it's just really somewhere where it could flourish and address that issue if it were better embraced by policymakers.
And we're starting to see that. Nebraska has set up a really exciting program where they're basically providing mobile crisis, giving people iPads and allowing them to use those to really access a competent medical professional when otherwise there just wouldn't be anyone anywhere near. And coming to people, meeting them where they are, and providing that whole health, that whole body health, is so vitally important, because otherwise we know what happens. People don't stop getting sick just because resources aren't there. They just end up in the systems that mm-hmm. can't care for them.
Excellent. And we're just going to take one more question before we move on to some audience-based questions. Honestly, if you could just provide some advice for the policymakers, for the advocacy leaders, one thing that they can do to improve the current state of mental health destigmatization processes right now, what would it be?
Gosh. How much time do we have?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I would say look at your own experience and your own staff's experience. Be the change you want to see in the world, right? Number one. Number two, I would say, again, I mentioned this just a minute ago, look at the parity law, look at other public policies that could help the experience of people with mental health conditions and addictions, number one. Number two, do something about it. Make it your priority. Because it is, to your point, the priority of your constituents.
Exactly. And I would say, unfortunately, I wish this was rocket science, but it isn't. And it just shows how deeply ingrained the stigma is. The simple things. Making sure we have enough treatment beds for people when they get sick. Eliminating that discriminatory IMD policy. That's a bite-sized, simple solution we could do tomorrow. We just need the political will.
Okay. And I agree. And, you know, in addition to holding, in their different districts, doing community engagement and town halls in their districts. And then something that the Congressional Black Caucus did I thought was really good in terms of increasing visibility. They had Taraji P. Henson come to Capitol Hill and testify. And it was a packed room. It went viral. But it really helped to raise the visibility of mental health.
And I would add, connect with your physicians, connect with your frontline treaters, prescribers, the people that are observing how this manifests in the community, and just understanding what's needed at that level. What are the resources that we may be lacking? What is the personnel that's maybe most strained? Where are we excelling and where can we grow and build and improve on? So,
for sure.
All right, great. So I guess we'll just take some questions from the audience now, if anyone had any.
said it and I missed it. I apologize, but I didn't hear anything about integrating behavioral and clinical health care, especially at the, of course, at the primary care level. So I'd like to hear how you all think we can take steps to make that happen and how big of an impact that might have.
Well, I think you flagged that.
In very general terms, as I said before, the brain is part of the body, so we have to start there. Secondly, I think looking at reimbursement policies to make sure that doctors are being reimbursed properly for the work that they are doing, which is, I think, an issue that has actually exacerbated some of the treatment or the provider shortages, and looking at models that work, like collaborative care. You know, there's a really, really good model that was out in Washington State. It's called collaborative care. It's very well named. As a communications person, I appreciate that because it is what it is. And looking at ways to essentially put someone with a mental health condition or an addiction into the system as if they were looking at the entire person. And one of the things that we have to really be aware of in those models, as I said before, looking at those models and actually taking those models forward, is how can they scale, where should they be, and how can we make this the norm and not the exception to the rule? So, you know, I would start by looking at those models and saying, how can we bring this to scale nationally?
I, about 40 years ago, worked for the American Psychiatric Association. Actually was the one that got Mental Health Awareness Week passed. At the time, I also lobbied. At that time, the insurance would cover $250 or 5 visits. Okay, that was it. So we've clearly come a long way. The first time anybody people realized that there was a mental illness, and I don't know if some of you were born then, was when Prozac came out. And suddenly there was a medication that treated mental illness, so therefore it must be an illness. 40 years later, I'm sitting here and I'm sort of hearing about the same things all over again, which is obviously unfortunate. But a couple of things, insurance doesn't cover psychiatric care, and psychiatric care is expensive. Also, there hasn't been a distinction between serious mental illness, bipolar, schizophrenia, personality disorder, depression. There's a range there. And lumping everything together into mental illness, I think, is incorrect. I think you need to, and I would think some of the violence that we've seen is probably personality disorders rather than depression or mental illness, and I think there needs to be a distinction. And one other thing, when I started, they were confining a lot of mental patients to, facilities or institutions, and that stopped, and they decided not to do that anymore because it was against their civil rights. So I have friends who've had children who really needed to be institutionalized, but you have to go to court to do that, and then they have to be released in 48 hours, one of whom committed suicide. So there are a lot of issues that are still out there, and I think we've gone too far in one direction, and that we need to figure out how to get the people that need help without going through a legal system and without making it so difficult for their loved ones to seek help for them. So I know that was a lot, but these are some of the things I was thinking as this was going on. Thank you.
Thank you for that. You're absolutely right. We need to improve our individualization of care, and even just our response to patients and making sure that there are no unavailable avenues across the entire board of care. Any other question?
Good morning. My name is Adrienne Griffin from the Maternal Mental Health Leadership Alliance. So why don't we change the name, right? We know words mean a lot, right? Mental health is so stigmatizing. Why don't we call it brain health? You saw when you said brain is part of the body, everybody in the room nodded, right? Thank goodness we moved away from behavioral health, which implies that you can get your behavior under control, right? So I just throw that out there. Words really make a difference.
I 100% agree.
Glad we took that extra question there.
100% agree with you on that. And I think, I've always had a viscerally negative reaction to behavioral health for the very reason that you're saying. I think, mental health, I think, is a whole other, brings in all these other things. So, rebranding, if you will, these sets of illnesses, and to get to the point that was just made about the different illnesses, it's like we don't collect up many other things in the healthcare system into just one very vague moniker. So I think that from a pure communications perspective, from a branding perspective, and from a how do we connect better with the public perspective, that's a really great point. It's a really great point. Let's talk about it as the brain.
Okay. I want to thank everybody who's up here. Thank you so much for this insightful discussion. Thank you.
Thanks again to the panelists, the forum organizers, and to Otsuka America Pharmaceutical. For more insights and the latest news in mental health care, be sure to head to mdmagazine.com. I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thank you for listening.